Eastside Solar Farms Wildlife Impact, and this is a briefing. I see Mr. Garrity and Mr. Ritter are the presenters on this.
I do believe, this is Nikki, I do believe Carrie and Christina were going to speak beforehand as well, and I know they're panelists, so let's give them a second to get on.
Okay.
You know, Chair, I was amazed to hear that Commissioner Keough had a spare bedroom. Whenever I'm there, he makes me sleep in the garage floor.
I know the room exactly. Yeah. I don't know where he left now. He went to his other spare.
I was going to take my rolling break, but I heard my name, so I came back. And the rooms have just recently become unoccupied. So.
Okay, who's the lead on this agenda item?
Go ahead, Christina. Carrie just said she's just listening.
All right, I will kick it off. Good morning, Chair Carpenter, Commissioners, Christina Lee, Region 5 Director. Happy to be with you this morning. I'm going to be very, very brief and hand it off quickly to the meat of the presentation. Several months ago, I was watching your meeting. I believe you were up in Bellingham, and I heard Commissioner Thorburn mention that there sounded like there were multiple solar projects being proposed around the state. And at that time, we were in the process of working with a project proponent and Klickitat County on a proposal there. So it seems really ripe for a briefing to you all, very timely. So there are several projects proposed in Klickitat County and many more around the state. And I'm very pleased that Habitat Program has added some capacity recently in Michael Garrity's new position to the really already excellent team that's working on this, that I was able to work with on this Lund Hill proposal in Klickitat County. So there are some challenges that we haven't seen before that are different with wind energy projects. So as I said, really a ripe time for this conversation. And I will just turn it over to Michael and Mike Ritter and be here to answer any kind of regional specific questions that you might have.
Thank you. Mr. Ritter?
I defer to Mr. Garrity, but thank you all for having us. Michael will kick us off.
Oh, hi. Oh. Figured out how to start video just in time. all right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for having us to talk about solar. I'm the relatively new division manager for energy, water, and major projects, which includes a lot of focus on hydropower and more recently more focus on other renewables like wind and solar. But I'm going to hand it over in a little bit to Mike Ritter, who's our mitigation biologist, focusing a lot on solar these days, but I wanted to provide a little bit of background. I also wanted to say hello to Phil Rigdon if he's still on the line. I spent a lot of time working with him in a previous job on the Yakima Integrated Plan. The purpose of our presentation is to update you on solar and wind development, provide a lay of the land around the state, especially in central and eastern Washington. We're going to talk about differences and similarities in the impacts of wind and solar. And we're also going to talk about our role in informing the solar and wind development process, how the rules of the game work for our role in the permitting and the local land use process now, and some thoughts that we have on the policy level for the future. And then I just wanted to say that WDFW appreciates and supports the important role that renewable energy, including solar and wind, play ensuring that we reduce carbon emissions statewide and globally. And that it also, both these technologies also offer an opportunity, especially if accompanied by new, like old or new storage technologies like pump storage or batteries, to slowly sort of fill in some gaps in the grid and maybe allow for more flexible hydropower operations as well. So with that, I'll hand it over to Mike to give the lay of the land.
You want me to run the slides, Michael, or?
That'd be great.
I'll see if I can share the screen here, folks. Hold on one second. Are you seeing it?
We are.
Great, great. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Mike Ritter. I'm located over in the Tri-Cities, and rare occurrence today, it's cloudy and rainy here. So it's quite nice, actually. I've been with the department for about 11, 12 years. When I first started out, I worked as the in the wind program exclusively, working with the wind industry to get the projects on the land and to consider some of the landscape impacts. Several years ago, I took on the role also as a habitat biologist here for Benton and Franklin counties. And then when solar started making a noise in the state, I volunteered to help lead our efforts statewide and continue to do that. And I'm really happy to be working with folks like Cassina and Michael and others to keep this stuff moving forward. So with that, we will move in to some slides. Let's see here. Maybe not. There we go. Got it? I don't know what you guys are seeing, so it's really frustrating for me. Are you seeing the Lind Solar Project?
Hey, Michael, can you go ahead and like click on slideshow? Because we're seeing your notes too, which you might not want us to see.
Thank you very much. Slideshow. There we go. Hold on. She's loading. There we go. How you doing?
Much better.
Thank you very much. So this is the Lind Solar Project, one of the first ones in the state. It's about 200 acres, and most of the solar projects in the state are incredibly larger than this. They're about 3 to 10 times larger. This one was constructed on mostly former dryland wheat fields. And what I'd like you to kind of pay attention to in this slide is these are panels that follow the sun during the day. And they're facing to the west right now. They're finishing out the day. Notice the spacing between the rows, the shading underneath the panels, and there is a 6 to 8 foot chain link fence around the entire facility. So that'll start the basis for our move here into solar across the state. So next, how much do we have there? Well, I thought I'd throw out the wind as well, since everybody's kind of seen that across the state. There's 37 wind projects that have occurred over the last decade plus. But solar has made a huge move into the state since 2018. And you can see on your screen there that we've got one operational. That's the one I just showed you up in Lind, which is here in Eastern Washington. And there's 16 proposed, and there's several more in the queue behind that. Those solar projects are very landscape intensive with their fences and their shading and things like that. And they add up to a lot of acres. And we'll kind of compare that a little bit later with wind projects. How's it look across the state? Well, here's all the little dots you're going to see bop up on your screen here. I thought I'd put the wind in there so you get an idea of where renewables are located across the state. Here's all the operational wind projects. You see Klickitat has the vast majority of them. I just had to put like a blob down there for them all. And one that's under construction over on the Thurston and Lewis County line. That's called the Skookumchuck Wind Project. And let's see here. I got to move something on my screen. Just bear with me one second here. There we go. There's our operational wind, solar project that we just talked about earlier in Lind in Adams County, North Adams County. And all those are the proposed solar projects across the state. And you can see they go from the Idaho border down to the Columbia River and all the way into Western Washington. Another graphic, these Duke projects all do have names. And one thing I'd like to say here, these projects didn't come as a surprise to us. The project developers contact us at the earliest possible moment. It could just be an introductory phone call to say, hey, we're thinking about building a solar project in your state. What should we know and who should we talk to and what species and habitats should we consider? And then those projects take about 2+ years before any groundbreaking occurs. So there's a lot of work that leads up to it, and we're engaged along with the counties, FSEC, if they choose to go that route, and the consultants and the landowners. So here's a list of those projects and their names and the sizes. These sizes are probably a little bit on the large size. They tend to lease a lot of land initially to kind of lock up the land as an interest. And then as they get more data on either the wind resources or the solar resources, they might those acreages might decrease slightly. And now we're going to turn it over to Michael for the next few slides.
Yeah, so I get the easy part of sort of talking about the common sense visual impacts here and habitat impacts. You can see with wind that they're spread out. You tend to have projects that are in the maybe 10 or 20,000 acres, maybe even more. And animals can continue to use them. There are issues that have to be attended to with habitat and birds and bats. But it's not fenced, and the habitat that was there can largely continue to exist. Maybe forward it to solar, Mike. The next slide. And then with solar, they're smaller, tend to be hundreds of acres or around 1,000 acres, mm-hmm. but the impact is more intense on the footprint. This illustrates the fencing that Mike mentioned earlier. You have 8-foot fences that keep wildlife out. Even small wildlife can't get under unless they're really small. There tends to be mowing and shading impacts on the affected land. So that just sort of the basic difference. So I think Mike might have the next slide and might have something to add on that.
I don't have anything to add on the two. You did a great job. Basically, wind is the landscape is open and connected. Land practices can continue at wind projects. In contrast to solar, where it's a little bit more concentrated, and a lot of the land practices that used to occur there cannot. So let's move on to some impacts. The ones showing here now are very similar to the wind project impacts and include both temporary and permanent impacts, such as roads and trenching for underground collector lines. And we address those for solar, very similar to how we did for wind. It's they add up the acres, and we talk about them, and we talk about how to remedy those impacts. Some of the impacts that we have identified as an agency that we feel are likely to occur at a solar facility, and I should say this right off the bat, there is virtually no science from around the world related to solar impacts on habitat and species. There's some from the desert southwest with desert bighorn sheep, tortoises, and with some connectivity issues. And there's some from South Africa for some grassland bird impacts or issues with them. So there's very little solar specific, but these are some of the impacts we've identified. And we're talking here in eastern Washington of shrub steppe habitat. And as you saw from those solar pictures, there's only like grass growing underneath those panels. So pretty much anything that's very tall has to be removed or gets converted to grasslands simply because of the shading and the maintenance that goes on. And then with that shading over here, you know, we have 300 days of nice warm sunshine a year. Well, not warm all the time, but in the summer it's really warm. And the plants have adapted to that. And now we've we're creating lots of microclimates and microhabitats through the shading that occurs, and we believe that there might be some changes to plant species and ecological functions and values, as well as the wildlife that use them. And Michael mentioned earlier about the fencing. This is chain link fence. It's 6 foot tall with the barbed wire on top. And we've recommended no barbed wire because of the deer and elk issues that might occur if there's barbed wire on top. But nothing can really get through the fences. And then we have the shading. The fencing, of course, impacts the animal movements across the landscape. And anyone who is familiar with Eastern Washington and chain link fences know that those fences can accumulate a large accumulation of tumbleweeds, which can be a huge fire hazard. Some of the other things that we have identified based on our discussion with the developers is that there could be some mowing that periodically occurs to keep vegetation down. And if mowing done at the wrong time of the year could affect those animals that we've identified, nesting birds. It affects the ground cover. And so I think there's a cumulative effect here of shading, changes in moisture, and mowing that we convert the habitat within these facilities to plants that are used to mowing and shading, which is not what our native habitat is. We've also talked about behavioral impacts to wildlife, whether they would be amenable to even being close to a fence and all this infrastructure or not. Another thing that we talked about over here is dust and snow maintenance. Those panels collect the sunlight, and we know there's a lot of dust in Eastern Washington. We get a little snow once in a while. And so those are all other issues we need to kind of address as we move through this process. I think the next slide, Michael, we decided we would tag team a bit. I'll go over this quickly so you know exactly what kind of solar is being proposed in the state. It is the top picture only. They are collection panels. They collect sunlight on both sides. They're called bifacial, and they track the sun throughout the day. They are not the bottom two pictures, which are similar to Southern California and the desert Southwest, that really heat up a lot and focus the sun's energy to a tower. And I will open this up for Michael now.
Yeah, so there's a lot of connections in terms of who we're working with on these issues as they're proposed, and as we think more prospectively on what the longer term landscape will look like. I'll speak to a couple of them, and Michael speak to I think three of them. So we work with the governor's office. Since I've come into my position, and I've started some conversations with Lauren McCloy, who's the energy advisor, about the need for some lease conflict solar siting processes and ways to starting the conversation around how we might improve our funding capacity as this as solar development gets more intense. We're also working with Department of Natural Resources because they have a goal of establishing 500 megawatts of solar on their state lands for trust funding purposes. And we want to make sure that they're thoughtful about impacts on habitat there. And I've been working with Dan Seaman, who's the relatively new renewable energy liaison there. So go for it, Mike.
Yeah. So I really work more on the field level out here and coordinating all of our actions with other WDFW regions and biologists. And as I said earlier, as soon as these projects are known to us in the state, which is very early on, we are in contact with local governments and the industry to discuss the projects. And I like to say that the project has the choice, it's their choice, to which type of permitting process they would like. They can go through the local county government permitting process, or they can choose the FSEC, which is the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council permitting process. All solar at this point is going through the local county government process. But those connections we have been established a long time ago through the wind process, and they were working with the same counties and some of the same personnel, both in the counties and in the industry and in WDFW. So we have a really good, strong working relationship from a field perspective. So what are we doing? Michael?
Yeah, so we've got an internal structure that's cross-programmatic. Mike and I meet regularly with habitat staff that's working on priority habitat and species to make sure that we're, and that especially Mike is cognizant in his work of impact on particular species, while we generally try and take sort of an ecosystem or habitat approach to it. Working with wildlife staff that has expertise on affected species, working with, starting to have conversations with NGOs like Washington Audubon, who are recently talked about connecting us with American Farmland Trust and Renewable Northwest, who are interested in this least conflict mapping project that takes areas around the state that might be good fits from a from just a, sort of a sun perspective, and overlays that with where there could be habitat concerns and where there might not be habitat concerns to sort of identify the places where proceeding could be the smoothest and maybe the least expensive for the developers. And we've been, Mike has really been taking the lead on some long-term internal documents about how our process works between the programs and between region and headquarters and getting back to the developers. And then he's also working with local governments on sort of how we can advise them about how to move ahead. Mike, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
No, I think that's good. The key thing is that we have a field level actions that we're doing to keep everyone engaged, and then Olympia level or headquarter actions that keep everybody engaged. And we frequently discuss and work through the issues together. Next. Michael, anything else?
No.
We are... We are open for discussion.
Very good. Thank you. We'll get take this screen down, and we'll see what commissioners have their hands up and which.
There you are.
Okay. I see Commissioners Grayville, Commissioner Anderson in that order, and I'll see what else happens here. Go ahead, David.
Thank you, Chair. Is there any sort of comparative data on the efficiencies of solar versus wind?
I'm sure there are, but I am not aware of them. It seems like that would be something that's very important for the industries to consider when they decide which type of project they're going to use.
Yeah, it just seems that I'd be very interested in knowing. That would kind of help identify the appropriate direction. I was alarmed at the size of these projects. You know, we are trying to acquire important habitat for fish and wildlife into the future, and these projects might be getting ahead of us in terms of the amount of acreage that they're occupying on the landscape, and certainly the habitat loss has to be significant compared to solar. Wind, absolutely.
Thank you, Commissioner Grabo. Commissioner Anderson, then I see Commissioner Smith and Commissioner Keogh, please.
Yeah, I was a little distracted earlier. Can you, if you covered this or inform me, but with regard to projects either current or proposed that might be on department lands, are there are there solar or wind projects on department lands, either proposed or operational right now?
You mean WDFW department lands?
Yes.
There is no solar projects proposed on WDFW lands, and there is a portion of one wind project, Wild Horse, that is on some of our lands.
Is Wild Horse a Quillamine area?
Yes.
I mean, that's Clockham?
Yes, in that area, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Commissioner Smith.
Where does Washington rate in terms of a state and with when all of these solar and wind ones are proposed are up and running? Where does Washington rate in terms of renewable wind and solar energy in the country?
A really good question, and thank you. I usually use a couple of websites to check on that, and they update when projects are actually operational. Hmm. So from a wind perspective, for many, many years, Washington was the first state in the country that had some framework for wind power projects. And we were always ranked in the top three in the nation. We're probably still in the top 10 in the nation for wind, but for solar, I do not know.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're just starting on solar. So yeah, we're down and way behind the Southwest.
I think it's safe to say that Bellingham's not going to be hosting any.
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. Commissioner Kehoe, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mike and Mike, for the presentation. Very interesting, really interesting topic. And it has, you know, which I like about it, has got a lot of different policy layers to it. And I don't want to tell Dr. Smith what to do, but this sounds like a good topic for environmental science, kind of a case study. I mean, it really points out that there are consequences, certainly, that maybe a lot of people don't understand in terms of an environment when you talk about solar and wind farms. And so my question is. You know, you mentioned my question has to do with the legal framework, kind of the regulatory framework. And maybe you can just let us know, you know, what I know it sounds like you are consulting, you know, on permitting process, but what teeth does the department have in terms of, this is the wrong solar farm for the wrong location. And I want to hear Commissioner Thorburn kind of weigh in on this. But I'm just like, you know, for example, here's a great place, but it's sage grouse, steppe habitat. And so, you know, how far can you go? You can, you know, that's one question. And is there any effort, if you don't have the authority, to create some sort of statutory authority for the department to have some teeth and not just be at the table, but rather have some sort of regulatory and authority and say over what takes place? So sorry if it's a long, convoluted question, but...
No, it's a really good point, and thank you very much. I would see if Michael or maybe even Cassina might have a response to that.
I can start with this latter part of your question. I think when I think about sort of, you know, the governor and the legislature are very interested in developing a lot of new renewable energy, and it has for many good reasons, a very green patina around it. So we are in a position where we have to kind of catch up and remind people that with any renewable energy source, pretty much from hydro to wind to now solar, there's a history of major impacts. And if you're just focused on the energy generation part of it, there's going to be impacts to species and habitat that aren't always at the forefront. So we're trying to find ways, like I said, we're just really beginning, at least under my since I've been in this position, I'd have to be beginning because I haven't been in it very long. But even before that, I think we had matured our role in the wind process and had have some longstanding 10-year-old procedures on that. We're developing similar internal processes on solar right now. And in terms of a framework, I think there's room from conversations I've just had in the last couple weeks with the governor's office and DNR and some NGOs about some siting considerations. It's not to the point of criteria yet exactly, but I think moving that direction, I think there's room for discussions about, you know, could there be some kind of fee associated with development that helps support our capacity to engage? And then probably in ascending order of political difficulty, there would be sort of getting to the teeth part. And is there a way where we can just say, is there a threshold of impacts that means it's a no go in a particular area that where you don't have an endangered species or present or something that actually creates that hook more naturally?
Yep. Mr. Chair, may I add to that?
Yes, please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. I think I would add to what Michael's saying in terms of the teeth that we have, like so many of our habitat issues outside of our direct authorities around hydraulic projects and fish passage, our influence, our impact or our ability to affect what happens really comes down to influence. I think under the existing laws that the strength of that influence may depend on whether they take the pathway through FSEC or whether they take the local government pathway. We have a fairly strong relationship with FSEC and ongoing contracts where FSEC has a history of using us as technical experts to inform their decisions, and there's more of a relationship there. They certainly are going to be influenced by the broader sort of politics that Michael mentioned, the push to green energy and that catch up that Michael described, where we hope to be able to remind people that they want green energy and they want to make sure that there are fish and wildlife resources for people in the future. If projects to the local government pathway, as Mike said, most of them have, the strength of the protections depend entirely on the way that individual local government's code is written. And as we know from our longstanding work with Growth Management Act and the Shoreland Management Act, there's quite a bit of variety there in terms of the strength of protections. I would say the biggest pattern I've seen over the years with the local government codes is a strong reliance on listed species as the most common trigger for protections under those local government codes. And that can be a real challenge, as Mike and Michael are describing, especially projects like wind and solar that cover large landscapes. Endangered species are certainly important, but we also have concerns about sort of the ecosystem more broadly, and that's often a little harder to sort of get a hook into the regulatory structure. Small seed for future conversations, and some of you may have heard about this from Jeff Davis, our conservation policy director, but there are growing conversations in the state realizing that as progressive as Washington's environmental laws are, that in particular relative to terrestrial species, relative to biodiversity, and relative to the effects of climate change, there are things we're catching in our current regulatory structure, which is largely built around no net loss. And so I still am hopeful that those would be regulatory changes we might be able to see in the coming years, because I think that would really give us a much stronger platform for talking about the impacts of project types like this.
Yeah, that's helpful. Gives a little bit more helps me understand. I mean, I'm going to be a cynic here. If I'm a developer, I'm going to go most of the time the path of least resistance. And so to me, that and I'd have no idea what the political landscape is around this in terms of, giving the department more regulatory authority over projects like this. I imagine it's, I just don't know, but it just seems to me to have a patchwork approach is not the best way to go. So that's one commissioner's opinion.
I think by chance our counselor has a comment here.
Yes, thank you, Chair and commissioners. I just want to add one more point on enforceability on these habitat type issues from Fish and Wildlife's perspective, and that is to tack on top of Margan's. When it is a local jurisdiction who's making a decision on a project, we have very recently represented the agency in a Land Use Petition Act case. If Fish and Wildlife believes that the local agency's decision did not abide by the principles in the Growth Management Act, or if it was applicable, the Shoreland Management Act, and believe that aspects of the environment were in fact being harmed by the decision of the local jurisdiction, then the only remaining relief that Fish and Wildlife can seek is to go to court. And just like any other outside citizen or aggrieved neighbor, to sue the local jurisdiction under the Land Use Petition Act and the developer arguing that the permit decision was erroneous. And recently, over a year ago now, there was such a Land Use Petition Act case that Fish and Wildlife filed in the city of Wenatchee against a developer a property owner who wanted to turn their one house 13-acre site on the edges of the city of Wenatchee. It was native shrub steppe habitat, and the city granted a permit to basically bulldoze all 13 acres and put in a number of homes on that site with what the agency felt was inadequate habitat mitigation for winter forage habitat for the mule deer. And so Fish and Wildlife sued and got a judgment from the Superior Court remanding to the city saying, city, you didn't look at the habitat impacts enough. Do it over. So, that path for the agency is, of course, utilizing your assigned lawyers and getting into a very adversarial type position.
Yeah, and thanks for that, Joe. I appreciate the fact that there's always legal challenges, but being an attorney myself, there's a lot of uncertainty in the legal world in terms of getting a court or judge or court of appeals to. I mean, you just don't know. I mean, you can make the strongest argument and then come out on the wrong side. And I know we have appeals, but so it's good to know that we do have some legal challenges, but it sounds to me in this kind of arena, it would be nice to have some regulatory authority as well to try to avoid having to go to sue in court. So,
okay, just a minute. I want to clarify a couple of things here. David Grayville, do you have your hand up again? If not, Nikki, take it down.
Thank you.
Okay, I assume Kim Thorburn, you probably have both hands up, but I don't see you on my screen.
I completely lost internet, so I tried to put my hand up on my phone, but it apparently isn't going up. I really am not sure what's going on with participants.
We have three commissioners that want to speak. So you will go first, and then there will be Commissioner Linville and Commissioner Anderson, and that should get us to the end of this agenda item. Commissioner Thorburn.
Okay. So thanks, Cassina, for following up on this. It is an issue that I've had long time interest in, and Commissioner Kehoe really raised the concerns that I wanted to point out, just in terms of comparing wind to solar and impacts on wildlife. On the impact chart that you showed, there are the behavioral impacts that you didn't call out. Of course, I think birds. With wind, there have been a lot of studies on sagegrass, obviously, because of the sighting of wind in sagegrass country. And one of the things that we know, even though it's dispersed more than solar, so you have this open country, the sagegrass vacate it. They don't reproduce. They close down their leks. The theory is that it's tall structures. That sageland naturally does not have tall structures, and so wildlife that reside in sageland with sagegrass is the studied species. Tend to avoid that and tend to not do well. So there are the behavioral impacts that are considerable with both of these types of energy development. I think as Commissioner Kehoe pointed out, the siting and the work that Audubon Washington is doing, the siting becomes really, really key, and we do have issues. It would be great to get to regulation, but I think we have a lot of education and outreach to do with partners so that they understand these kinds of impacts that it has on wildlife, so that we can get to the point where we do have some regulatory authority, because that's first going to have to be granted elsewhere. So I really appreciate the Mike's. I heard Mike Ritter talking to the grass group last fall, and it reminded me again about my concerns about the lack of understanding that both of these important energy resources have on wildlife. I'm just glad that we're involved. We need to be more involved.
Thank you,
Commissioner Thorburn. Commissioner Linville, and then Commissioner Anderson.
Well, I want to start out by saying that it's really nice to see Mike Ritter.
Very good to see you.
I wish it was in person. For the rest of you, Mike was essentially a supervisor to be at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and he's probably wondering how in the hell I got to be his boss's boss. And I think that's a good question.
No. I know the story.
Actually, we're all wondering that, Commissioner Linda.
Yeah, fair enough. So thank you for this presentation. I would like to I take my role as an Eastern Washington commissioner very seriously and being kind of a conduit. And so I would like to just kind of highlight some of the social impacts on wind and solar energy in Eastern Washington. Sometimes it's a real kind of double-edged sword for some of us because, often we feel like, for example, we get train loads of waste from King County, and it's in our transfer stations, and we get human waste from King County, and it's put on our ag fields, and we feel often that we are told what to do where we live in our communities by folks who are distant from us, and green energy falls into that sometimes too, and so I don't really have anything terribly specific other than to just sort of flag that let's also not lose sight of the social impacts that might come from this as well. I'm obviously very, very, very concerned on the wildlife habitat impacts, but I think Commissioner Thorburn covered those really well. And just kind of, it might not pop into people's heads that if this starts feeling thrust upon Eastern Washington, there might not be a lot of social tolerance for it. And it gets complicated in the fact that we are often also living in counties with a very, very low tax base. And so we also might need the tax money that comes from it too. And so it's like, we start feeling like, well, is this a friend or is this a foe? And so I think on how these get permitted and how they are presented to the communities and maybe some, you know, education as they are developed would be really good to be really for us all to be very thoughtful about the impacts to the people.
Thank you, Commissioner Linville. Commissioner Anderson, you get the wrap.
Okay, I'll try to do that. I guess, you know, overall, I think, you know, the concerns about, you know, degradation of the landscape and habitat is pretty real. If you look at what we've experienced over time in Western Washington, at least, but also other places regarding fish and wildlife habitat, and I'm in particular thinking about salmon habitat. You know, it's a lot of things were seen as important and good, and didn't quite turn out quite the way we would like. So, you know, I think we need to be cognizant of that, and I think the department is wise in starting to build the capacity to, or further the capacity to engage. I think what I heard was real smart about the engagement effort. I think building the science and the capacity to be as much of an expert as we can be here, you know, working with others, of course, but I think it's crucial that we be seen for that, so that there will be a place at the table, and it could lead to more credibility, would lead to more credibility, I think, that then would allow us to be better positioned to protect the things that we're responsible for. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Any other comments before we move on? Staff, all of you, thank you very much.